This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
A genocide under the watch of the international community cannot be tolerated. Another Holocaust in the history of humankind is not acceptable.
That was Kumbudzo Ntshavheni, a minister in the South African presidency, on the cabinet's decision to withdraw its diplomatic staff from Israel, saying Pretoria seeks attacks on Gaza as genocide. Details coming up. Also, witnesses say the past 24 hours have seen more of the most intense Israeli shelling of Gaza. And Ukraine's foreign minister slams both the Israeli and U.S. ambassadors to South Africa. These stories and more on African News Tonight. We start with our top story. An Israeli witnesses say in Israel in the past 24 hours have been seen some of the most intense Israeli shelling of Gaza. Today, Hamas and Israel have exchanged heavy fire, with Hamas saying it has launched rockets into Israel from Lebanon. In Gaza, the Hamas-run health ministry says the month-old conflict has claimed more than 10,000 lives. Israel says more than 1,400 people died in Israel communities when Hamas attacked them on October 7th. Hamas also took more than 240 people hostage that day and has them hidden in Gaza. The top United States diplomat, Secretary of State Antony Blinken, today wrapped up a diplomatic mission in the region with a stop in Turkey. He said his discussions throughout the mission have focused on how to expand humanitarian aid into Gaza, how nations can make sure the conflict does not spread, and what can be done to create a lasting, just peace between Israelis and Palestinians. We have VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell on the line now to discuss the position of President Joe Biden and his administration on the conflict. Welcome to African News Tonight, Anita.
Thank you so much, Yehia.
So, Secretary Blinken has been in Israel and the Middle East for the second time in less than a month. What message was he carrying for the Biden administration?
Well, let me just amend that to say he wasn't just in Israel and the Middle East. He was in Israel, Jordan, the West Bank, Cyprus, and Iraq. This was a whirlwind trip, yet more of this shuttle-style diplomacy by Secretary of State Antony Blinken. He met, really importantly, with officials all around the region, especially the Palestinian Authority chief Mahmoud Abbas, to update on humanitarian situations in the West Bank and in Gaza. But right now, the issue of the day right now is calls for a ceasefire from some quarters versus calls for a humanitarian pause from the U.S., neither of which is being entertained by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So this is a situation we find ourselves in here, with the Americans trying to encourage the Israelis and all the partners in the region to embrace this idea of a humanitarian pause to let civilians out, and it's just not happening at this time.
So what happens? I mean, Israel has still is rejecting the idea of pauses, while the Arab and Muslim nations are instead demanding an immediate ceasefire. So what happens now?
If I knew the answer to that, I would find better employment, I suppose. But that's the big question, right? As the White House told us on Friday night in briefing journalists, this is a difficult, difficult, difficult situation. This is a kind of no-win situation where nobody is going, or rather, you cannot make everybody happy in this situation. So this is a prolonged game of diplomacy, of negotiation, of checking everybody's interests and reminding everybody that, you know, the most important thing, really, as Israel has said, is to minimize civilian casualties while also eradicating Hamas. But it's got to be a push and pull between these two objectives, I suppose.
And President Biden is coming under increasing pressure politically as well as diplomatically for, you know, his administration for its support of Israel in this conflict. So how is the White House responding to that?
Well, so far, and I think you're referring to the weekend poll that showed that Trump had a lead over Biden in terms of Israel-Palestinian issues. So far, the White House is holding the line on this. Biden has said repeatedly that he believes this is an existential crisis for Israel and that there needs to be a Jewish state. I haven't seen any deviation from that. The furthest that the administration seems to be going is behind the scenes, where they're speaking to Israeli leadership about the need for a humanitarian pause, the need to minimize civilian casualties, and the need to keep the, you know, the rights of Palestinian citizens first and foremost, because as we know, there are 2.3 million people in Gaza. Not all of them are members of Hamas. Not all of them are supporters of Hamas. A lot of them are children, and this needs to be kept front and center, as the UN keeps encouraging and demanding. This needs to be kept in front and center. But so far, we're not seeing President Biden deviate at all from his strong, principled support of the Israeli state.
And lastly, so now we have, I'm just wondering, we have a northern Gaza and a southern Gaza, essentially now. How does that work?
That's a very deep question. If you mean, do we have Israeli activity, military activity in northern Gaza and southern Gaza? I mean, it's just a complicated situation that could change in the blink of an eye. I would hesitate to characterize it at this state with you know, bombs dropping, rockets flying. But suffice to say, going back to what the White House said, it's an incredibly difficult situation.
It is a very difficult situation. Thank you for your input. We just go with what we have. Appreciate your input on the matter. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
For more on what's been happening in the conflict, I spoke earlier today with journalist Linda Grantstein in Jerusalem. So we understand both sides have been exchanging fire. What have you learned today?
That there has been some of the heaviest fire since this conflict began in Gaza. Gaza City is surrounded, as you said. The Israeli army says that another top Hamas commander was killed. And there are still, despite Israel really pleading with citizens in Gaza to leave northern Gaza and move south, there are still an estimated 300,000 Palestinian civilians in northern Gaza.
Linda, essentially today there is a northern Gaza and a southern Gaza. Is there any word on what comes next for the Israeli military in northern Gaza?
Well, Israel is surrounding, Gaza City and says that it is making a lot of progress in trying to destroy the network of underground tunnels that Hamas has built under Gaza. And, Israel says that those tunnels and Hamas bunkers include being a large one underneath the Shifa hospital, where thousands of Palestinians are sheltering. And the general manager of the hospitals, Mohammed Zakouk, says that the roof of a building at Shifa was damaged by an Israeli strike, resulting in deaths and injuries. The army has not yet commented on this, Israeli airstrike.
And U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has just left the region. What has the Israeli response been to Blinken's visit and his message from the United States?
Well, Blinken, talked about the need for more humanitarian aid to get into Gaza, and he also talked about a ceasefire or a humanitarian pause, as the president has called it. In terms of humanitarian aid, Israel says that it's willing to let humanitarian aid into Gaza, but it has to make sure that none of that aid is getting to Hamas. In fact, over the last week, Israel has allowed more humanitarian aid into southern Gaza, food, medicine, but not fuel. Israel says that fuel can be used to power the rockets that Hamas is still sending from Gaza towards Israel. In fact, there were some long-range rockets towards central Israel, and Hamas apparently even fired rockets from Lebanon at northern Israel. There were no Israeli injuries in those, but Israel has turned down Secretary Blinken's calls for a ceasefire or even a humanitarian pause, saying that Israel will not agree to a ceasefire unless all the hostages are freed.
That was reporter Linda Grandstein in Jerusalem. We spoke a few hours ago. Ukraine's foreign minister Monday held talks with his South African counterpart in Pretoria that were overshadowed by the war in Gaza. Kate Bartlett reports that a fiery news conference after the meeting saw the South African minister slam both the Israeli and U.S. ambassadors to South Africa.
The conflict in Gaza, rather than the war in Ukraine, dominated a press conference in Pretoria following a meeting between Ukrainian Foreign Minister Dmytro Kuleba and his South African counterpart Naledi Pandor. It was Kuleba's first visit to South Africa as he tries to shore up support for Kyiv on a continent where Moscow holds considerable influence. Pretoria has officially remained neutral on the Ukraine war, but critics, including U.S. officials, have accused the South African government of essentially siding with Moscow. South Africa's Pandor expressed her desire to see a peaceful, negotiated end to the war in Europe.
We are deeply concerned, Minister, about the continuing war between Russia and Ukraine, the continuing loss of lives, and the very, very worrying humanitarian situation.
While refraining from condemning Russia, Pandor repeatedly brought up Israel, saying at one point its response in Gaza was one of collective punishment. The South African government position has always been pro-Palestinian, and on Monday, an official in the presidency announced Pretoria was recalling its diplomats from Israel. Pandor also said the government did not appreciate recent comments made by the Israeli ambassador to the country and took a swipe at U.S. Ambassador Ruben Brigati, who earlier this year accused South Africa of providing arms to Russia, a claim that was never substantiated.
Well, the ambassador of Israel has been making a number of comments almost akin to the statements that were made without proof by the United States ambassador a few months ago. There seems to be a strange practice among some ambassadors in South Africa that they can just say what they like.
She added that maybe that is because as an African country, they don't respect us. For his part, Ukrainian Foreign Minister Kuleba repeatedly used terms Pretoria avoids on the Russian-Ukraine war, referring to the invasion and Russian aggression. He noted that as part of the former Soviet Union, Ukraine had supported South African struggle against apartheid and stressed that Kyiv is trying to help African countries navigate food insecurity caused by the conflict in Europe. Kuleba said discussions with Pandor had been positive and opened a new chapter in Ukrainian-South African relations. He also expressed concern over the crisis in the Middle East. Asked by reporters if the situation in Gaza was drawing the world's attention away from Ukraine, he cautioned against comparing what is happening in Ukraine and what is happening in the Middle East, saying, "People are people everywhere." Still, he said, it was true that many of the daily tragedies in Ukraine have become routine for media.
We in Ukraine find it extremely painful to see how the deaths of civilians, the deaths of children, and other mass destruction remains unnoticed. But we understand that this is how the world acts.
But he said while the media's attention may have shifted, he did not think that Ukraine was receiving less political attention. Kate Bartlett, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You're listening to African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Trade officials, national leaders, and business people say they are confident that Washington's centerpiece economic pact with sub-Saharan Africa will continue well into the future. The United States, under its African Growth and Opportunity Act, AGOA, gives eligible countries tax-free access to American markets for a wide range of products, from motor vehicles to minerals. But AGOA must be renewed by 2025. Darren Taylor reports.
South Africa's Trade Minister Ebrahim Patel told journalists he felt assured the U.S. Congress would extend AGOA by at least 10 years in 2025. He was speaking shortly after a three-day AGOA forum with African and United States officials ended in Johannesburg on Saturday. Since President Bill Clinton introduced AGOA in 2000, sub-Saharan African countries that meet requirements such as respecting human rights have earned billions of dollars by exporting tariff-free products to the U.S. Patel told VOA he's happy there was agreement at the forum that AGOA be improved to help Africa industrialize and boost its manufacturing capacity. Patel said in the future it would be important for AGOA to build on the developments it had already sparked across Africa, like its creation of regional value chains. He referenced South Africa's automobile industry.
When we export a vehicle to other parts of the world and to the United States, we're now beginning to pull in rubber that comes from Cote d'Ivoire, that goes into the making of a tire for the car, electric harnesses from Botswana that holds the wiring system of the car together, the copper that is used to send the electronic signals in a vehicle comes from Zambia, the seat covers come from Lesotho. So you're beginning to see Africa doing what it needs to do, which is to industrialize off the back of these market opportunities.
Earlier, President Cyril Ramaphosa said Africa didn't want to be just a source of critical raw materials and a producer of commodities. The South African leader said AGOA countries would benefit more from keeping these materials in-house and transforming them into goods that could be sold globally, rather than exporting the resources to countries with greater manufacturing capabilities. In a press briefing, U.S. Deputy Secretary of Commerce Don Graves said President Joe Biden's administration is committed to helping AGOA countries achieve this.
We certainly have talked about the potential of bringing our companies and our know-how to bear in building additional capacity, ensuring that we're building the type of workforce that is able to make processed or finished products so that those can be sold across the world. Why is this important? Because the U.S. believes that we should be investing in these markets, building stronger middle class across the continent, because then they will be able to buy more American products.
But manufacturing capacity is low, with many African countries enduring high levels of poverty and inequality. Most participating nations lack the legal infrastructure, the transportation network, and processing capacity to take full advantage of AGOA. U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai told journalists AGOA must be modified to reflect Africa's growing importance.
By 2050, one in four human beings on the planet will be African. The African population is young. It is vibrant. The potential is here. We know that the future is Africa. To all of the aspirations for the continent in terms of industrialization, reindustrialization, value chains, we really want to capture the changes in the global economy, the developments here on the continent, and reflect that in an AGOA program that is fit for the times and that is preparing us for the future.
Earlier, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the Biden administration wanted to work with Congress to improve AGOA, not just renew it without changes. Congress must renew the program by 2025. There are critics who say it's a neo-colonial effort by the U.S. to reap benefits from Africa, or to counter China's booming trade with African nations. Other critics, including Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni, say AGOA requirements on such issues as human rights protections, rule of law, and democracy are an attempt to force what he called Western values on African states. The U.S. has criticized Uganda's recent Anti-Homosexuality Act, which imposes stiff penalties against same-sex relations. And British and European leaders also condemned the law. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
In Cameroon, people are marking the 41 years that President Paul Biya has been running the government. At 90, Biya is the world's oldest head of state. Moki Edwin Kindeka reports from Yaoundé. Yeah.
This song titled Paul Biya blasts through loudspeakers in Monatele District near Cameroon's capital Yaoundé, where several hundred supporters of President Paul Biya gathered on Monday to celebrate his 41 years in office. Rosa Bikay sings that Biya is the wise man of Africa. Fru Jonathan is a senior official of Biya's CPDM party and the Cameroonian leader's close aide. He says activities to commemorate Biya's years as president took place in all 360 districts of the Central African state. He says supporters are pleading with Biya to run again in the 2025 election.
Today, newspapers, televisions, and so on can go on to operate and say anything and even insult the president and go free. In 1982, we had just one political party. Today, we have more than 250 political parties. We're talking about road infrastructure, energy, the seaports, the airports. We used to have one university in this country in 1982. We now have 11. Secondary schools and high schools are dotted all over.
Biya was Cameroon's prime minister starting in 1975. He became president in 1982 after Cameroon's first president, Ahmadou Ahidjo, who took office in 1960 following independence from France, stepped down due to health reasons. Biya has won all elections in Cameroon since the advent of multi-party politics in 1990. Opposition politicians accuse him of silencing his opponents. Some civil society groups and the opposition say Biya rigs elections and tortures and intimidates his opponents. Biya's supporters and CPDM party deny the accusations and say he has fairly won all elections and is loved by a majority of Cameroonians. Yusunyu Oma is an unemployed university graduate. He says it is absurd that in his 35 years of age, he has known only one president whom he says is responsible for Cameroon's snail-paced development.
A president who has been there for 41 years has exhausted all the ideas he brought in, and there is no new idea that he can bring in that will help the development of a country. So it is really a pity that we have people who are still calling on the president, who is virtually looking into his grave, to stand again as president. At what age? It is really unheard of.
Yusinu said Biya has failed to end the fighting with English-speaking rebels who want to separate from the French-speaking part of the country. That fighting is estimated to have killed at least 6,000 people in the northwest and southwest regions since 2017. Cameroon also faces a challenge from Islamic extremists aligned with the Nigerian-based Boko Haram group. Boko Haram attacks have killed more than 36,000 people, mainly Cameroon, Niger, Chad, and Nigeria. Critics also say government corruption has sunk Cameroon into deep poverty. Biya, who is hardly seen in public, has not said if he will run for office again. The president did not come out during celebrations marking his 41 years of leadership. The government has always said Biya is in very good physical and mental health. Biya is the oldest leader in the world and the second longest serving president after his neighbor Teodoro Obiangema of Equatorial Guinea. Moki Edwin Kinzuka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Al Santos, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.